Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. So thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. Today's podcast will be on the disappearance of Alyssa Turney. This will be part one. I heard about this case a few years ago, and for some reason, it really stuck with me, and with some recent updates about the case that I kind of stumbled across, I thought I might cover it because I felt this important enough for us to all know. All right, let's jump right in.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Now, I want to start off by saying much of my source material came from Sarah Turney's podcast, which is called Voices for Justice. I highly recommend you listen to that after this one, sort of an accompanying thing, because you'll get a lot more background and deep information from her. She's fantastic. Sarah is the younger sister of Alyssa Turney. Now, there's quite a bit of background information before we even get to Alyssa's disappearance, but every bit of it is important to give you sort of the whole broad picture of what very well might have happened to her. So it's a lot of backstory, but it does pertain, so just stick with me. So Alyssa Marie Strom, or that was her biological father's last name, as sources stated her mother was married to him, well, she was born on April 3rd, 1984 in Phoenix, Arizona. Her parents were Barbara Farner and Stephen Strom. On the podcast, Voices for Justice, Alyssa's sister's podcast, as I said, she actually got to interview Alyssa's biological father. So in summation of what he said that he met Barbara while he was working in real estate in California. Barbara herself was a loan officer. So let's get a little bit of backstory about Barbara. This is the mother of Alyssa Turney and Sarah Turney. She was born in 1958 in Texas. She was the third of four children. And the family moved around a bit. And the family remembers that Barbara was pretty stubborn and had always loved kids and wanted to be a mother, though she never really wanted to get married. As a teenager, Barbara fell in love and had a baby when she was 19 years old. But that relationship was not to last, and then she met Stephen. Stephen had a client who needed a mortgage loan, and so he met up with Barbara. They got to kind of know each other, and he asked her out. Now, Barbara already had a 2-year-old son at this point, John, from that previous relationship. His bio father was around maybe a tiny bit, but not really involved in his life. And it was said that the ex was a little vindictive towards Barbara, like stole her car and just kind of some weird shit. So Stephen took Barbara and John to Disneyland. He said that he carried John on his back when little John got tired. He was a toddler. John challenged Barbara's authority, as kids do when one of the parents is missing and, you know, the child is hurting, right? So Stephen claimed that he helped Barbara sort of contain John, and through kind of having that sort of united front, if you will, John became like just the best kid. So he said 6 months into dating, Barbara eventually moved herself and John in with Stephen and Stephen's father. They were working together, building or renovating a house together. Stephen's father adored Barbara and told Stephen to marry her because she was a good girl. So off they went to Vegas. They got married in 1982, met the rest of his family. It was all good. Stephen's sister then started a business and invited Stephen and Barbara out to Phoenix to help with the business. They rented a place and started their new life together. They believed it was going to be happily ever after. But I wouldn't be here if it were, right? So Stephen said that Alyssa was a planned pregnancy. Stephen indicated that he and Barbara were very excited to be parents. And John loved newborn baby Alyssa very, very much. He was a great big brother by all accounts. Both parents fawned over her. She was an easy baby, but Stephen said she did have a fire inside of her. So when Alyssa was about 3 years old, Stephen noticed that Barbara was being kind of quiet and she seemed rather depressed. Now, she was a naturally quiet woman, but he knew something was up, right? So he asked her, you know, what's wrong? And she said flat out, you know, I want to separate. And she asked him to leave the house. He didn't want to push her, so he moved out of the house. But this is because she had met Michael Turney. So he came into the bank. This is how Michael met Barbara. He came into the bank that Barbara worked at to get a second mortgage on his home, according to Barbara's best friend at the time. And then the next day after he met Barbara, he sent her flowers to work. Then he kept doing that. He pretty quickly asked to take her to lunch, knowing full well that she was married. But according to this BFF, Barbara was unhappy in her marriage to Stephen, and so they began having an affair. Well, then Barbara moved out of their house and in with Michael pretty quickly. Stephen asked her if she really thought that was a good idea, and Barbara told him, you know, Michael's this great guy. Now, Michael and Stephen did meet at least once because Stephen said that they shook hands and that was it. But Barbara did finally admit that she'd been having an affair with Michael, and Stephen said she did act a little ashamed of herself. But Michael and Barbara were actually married nearly the day after the divorce was final from Stephen. I mean, it was just like immediate. And then Barbara started telling Stephen that out of nowhere, Alyssa had begun wetting the bed at about 3 years old. Stephen indicated that she did not do that when she was visiting him. Now, you have to remember, this is sidebar, that she's 3 years old, and a lot of kids that are 3 years old are still potty training. So, you know, maybe she was potty trained before she was three. It does happen. It's not out of the ordinary, but having an accident in the bed at 3 years old doesn't seem out of the ordinary. But if Stephen is telling the truth and that Alyssa, toddler Alyssa, was not having accidents in the bed at his house, so then we have to kind of look at that, right? So a child who is fully potty trained and does not have accidents in the night usually only begins wetting the bed after pretty specific circumstances. Stressful events such as, I don't know, parents separating and a new parent being introduced is one of them. So this does jive. So getting back to the story, right? Stephen got depressed, felt that he couldn't work. He lost a bunch of weight. He gave up his business. His house got repossessed. He did spend time with Alyssa at first, and he wanted to spend time with John because he had been really his father figure. But Barbara and Michael Turney refused. This is all Stephen's point of view, so take that as you will. But according to Stephen, Michael and Barbara began keeping Alyssa from him. He said he went to court and the judge told him that Barbara had sole custody, that he only had visitation, so she could withhold the baby from him. But I have a law degree and this seems excruciatingly odd because custodial parents cannot deny court-ordered visitation. But this was also back in the 80s, so maybe the laws were different then, but you can't do that shit now. So Stephen indicated that it was obvious to him pretty quickly that he was not going to be allowed to see his daughter. And he stated Barbara didn't let John's father really see John either. He felt defeated and he gave up. He wasn't proud of it. He moved back to California and he went to work with a friend, and that was the last time he saw his daughter, Alyssa. So when Alyssa was 3 years old, Barbara and Michael got married. Michael is again very vital to this story. So this is kind of, that was the beginning stages of the background story, but now we're going to get into the meat of the background story. This stuff is important. So Michael Roy Turney was 40 years old when he met Barbara. She was 30. He was born on June 19th, 1951 in Phoenix, Arizona. He was the youngest of four kids. He apparently loved music, as did his dad, and they traveled around playing music together. His father was a roofer by trade and a part-time boxer for the paychecks needed to support the family. They were extremely poor. Michael's father was scrappy, liked to fight, and it sounded like he might have had anger problems as well as an alcohol problem. Michael was described as very athletic in his youth, according to Sarah. This is Sarah who has the podcast. This is his daughter. She's the baby of the family. Michael loved playing baseball, but the family had to move around a lot, so he didn't really get to kind of explore the sports as much as he probably wanted to. Many claimed the grandfather made the children stand at attention for hours or else get beat with a belt. So the grandfather is Michael's father. Sarah's talking about her grandfather. So Michael's dad would make the kids stand at attention for hours or else the belt. Stories of Michael and the sisters that he had were sexually abused by Michael's father. Michael's older brother, one older brother, James, and Michael famously did not get along. So Michael dated his high school sweetheart and stated he was drafted into the army and went straight to Vietnam, but then he later admitted to a judge that he actually had never been to Vietnam. But when he was in the military, he was taught chemical warfare and artillery, which will come into play later, I promise. When he got back, he married his high school sweetheart and he began working. So interesting points about Michael's earlier life. His father and at least one of his brothers, or he has the one brother, as well as Michael himself, used to use passive recording setups to record all phone calls coming in or going out as long as the receiver was raised or the handheld part of the phone was taken up off the phone, which will also come into play soon enough. So Michael's father used to record phone calls. And then Michael and his brother also recorded phone calls. Okay, so Michael got married to his first wife when he was 22 in 1973. He worked as a Maricopa County Sheriff's Office deputy from 1970 to 1974. Michael and his first wife had three sons together. An old co-worker stated that Michael was a good cop, but he was unable to let his anger go under specific circumstances. He told everyone the politics were too much, and that's why he quit. But others state he had to step down for messing with evidence and a cover-up. So this evidence involved him covering up evidence from when his older brother James had shot his own wife, Donna. Thankfully, she did survive. Another officer stated Michael's behavior at the crime scene as, quote, grossly inappropriate. Michael was obsessed with Donna, and this sparked a lifelong sexual desire for women that he could not otherwise have. Again, this is according to Sarah's podcast. It was very Machiavellian, you know what I'm saying? He wrote a fantasy essay about being sexually or having sex with his brother's wife. Also, Michael sexually assaulted his first wife's sister by handcuffing her to a bed. She was 16 years old, and he claimed to have been sleepwalking. He sexually assaulted another one of his first wife's sisters as well, but that sister fought back, and he did stop. So once he quit working for the police department, he went to work as an electrician. He and his first wife eventually divorced in 1979. It was unclear to me at first, but it became apparent by listening to Sarah's podcast that Michael somehow managed to retain full custody of all three of his sons against their own mother. And in the 70s, this would have been highly unusual. And then during the summers, Michael paid a babysitter because obviously he had to work and the kids were out of school. And the babysitter said that Michael was great with his three boys. But then one day, he asked her to give him a massage after a workout. Later that night, and she was staying in the home for the summer like a live-in babysitter. Later that night, he came and asked her if she wanted him to massage her. She got very uncomfortable. She told him no. The next day, she called her mom, and the mother came and got her immediately. No more summertime babysitting, staying with Uncle Michael. So this was a niece of his in the house. Sarah Turney, the daughter, uncovered some home movies of her father asking different, very young girls, all below the age of 10, I would say, to talk. He'd ask them to say their name, and then he would proceed to tell each of them how purty they were. Well, you're just so purty. Trust me. It was creepy. But after Michael and Barbara got married, Michael adopted Alyssa and John. Again, I don't know how that was legal, but I guess if they could say that Stephen abandoned the children, then maybe. But when Alyssa was nearly 5 years old, baby Sarah was born. Michael and Barbara decided to have a baby together to sort of bring the blended family members together. Very Brady Bunch, if you will. And Michael would tell the children their whole lives that he would not allow words like stepson or stepdaughter or any of that sense in the home, that they were all family. Now, from the beginning, Barbara's sisters, according to Sarah Turney's podcast, Voices for Justice, I keep saying that because most of my source material or a good chunk of it comes from her and you should listen to it. But anyway, that Michael treated Alyssa very differently than the other kids. Michael stated that, of course, this was false for the record. You know, Barbara's sisters were flat out lying that there wasn't any difference made between the children. And there wasn't any mention of him treating John any differently, though, which is good, I guess, in its own way. Now, sources stated that Sarah, this is the baby sister, watched hours and hours of home movies of the family, and it was noted that, quite obviously, Michael was not as affectionate with Alyssa as he was with all of the other children. So, as a small child, Alyssa was described as a headstrong but sweet and kind little girl. But she was aware, even from a very young age, that there was a difference being made between the kids. Barbara's sisters said that when Alyssa was around 7, she asked why her daddy didn't love her. I heard stories from several people who were around or in the inner circle talk about how, you know, if something went wrong or if the kids were playing and something unforeseen but minor would happen, Michael would get frustrated and then he would take it out on Alyssa. One home movie audio, you can hear Michael calling out, as Sarah and Alyssa approached for attention, and he flat out told Alyssa to move out of the way. He was very dismissive when Alyssa wanted affection and attention. It was very much, come here, Sarah, come here. No, Alyssa, you go away, go. Just go on, go find something to do. But like perpetually. So around this time, Barbara apparently began to notice that Michael was not the man that he had appeared in the beginning, that the advertising was not the actual product. He had put on quite a show of himself being nearly perfect, but she was seeing that he was far from it. He was becoming more violent and paranoid as time went along. And remember, he was already recording all phone calls. This is important to remember. Barbara would tell her sister that some of the holes in the walls were not necessarily from the younger boys. So one time Alyssa accidentally ingested some of Michael's medications and she had to be taken to the hospital to get her stomach pumped. Nearly that same time, little Sarah had somehow gotten out of the house. She had walked into the road and was hit by a car and taken to the hospital. Both girls were then taken by CPS or Child Protective Services. Michael made the decision to check himself into a mental health facility for a few months. Also, this would be the beginning of a lifelong obsession with the electricians union that he had joined in the 1970s. It became an actual problem for Michael around 1986. So what happened was that he failed a test to get a promotion. He said it was rigged purposefully so that they didn't have to promote from within. He printed and he distributed information and even filed an official complaint. This went on and on for years, guys. But coworkers complained that he recorded their conversations and so on. I mean, the level of paranoia, right? So Michael stated the union began to call at all hours of the night, and this might actually have a tiny bit of accuracy because Sarah states this as well, but perhaps not to the extent that Michael would say later, like the constant harassment. Again, this union business will come into play later, so keep it in the back of your mind. So when Alyssa was kindergarten age, Michael began proclaiming she was behind, and he would tell anyone that would listen that she had a learning disability. And as she went up in grades, he was also able to convince the principal of her school and her third grade teacher that she had what he called ADD, or attention deficit disorder, which is now ADHD, inattentive type. So a bit of science. According to the Child Mind Institute, quote, in children with the inattentive subtype of ADHD, the primary symptoms are being distracted, forgetful, and disorganized with little to no hyperactivity. These children can fly under the radar at school and at home, often being misunderstood as lazy, spacey, and callous. Symptoms of inattentive ADHD include failure to pay close attention to details, careless mistakes, difficulty maintaining sustained attention on disliked tasks like homework, losing important items like school materials, keys, cell phones, not seeming to listen when spoken to directly, not following through on instructions, and failing to finish schoolwork or chores, trouble staying organized, getting distracted easily, being frequently forgetful in daily activities like brushing teeth. Inattentive ADHD symptoms are thought to be caused by deficits in executive functioning, the cognitive process that enables us to pay attention to what is most important at a given time. It's involved in planning and initiating tasks, time management, organization, and emotional control. So in the podcast, Barbara's BFF and others wholly disagreed with this. No one believed Alyssa had this at all. Michael would tell everyone again who would listen that Alyssa had a learning disability and that he had to hire a tutor to teach her her ABCs. Barbara's best friend stated that this is completely untrue. Alyssa had known her ABCs and 1, 2, 3s prior to kindergarten, And as if that's not enough proof that he lied, Sarah was able to find a home movie of Alyssa singing the ABC song when Sarah was still an infant, meaning that Alyssa was only 4 years old, not quite five. But Michael was so busy shooing her out of frame, it would be easy to miss her singing that song. The BFF also said she would write her name or could write her name even before kindergarten, so it doesn't sound like there's any delays at all. But in all actuality, Alyssa never felt equally loved. That much was obvious. Also, when Alyssa was around 7 years old, Barbara began to question Michael's treatment of Alyssa to the point that she actually took her to a doctor, and Sarah apparently as well, to be examined for sexual abuse. And it turns out that Alyssa did have some scar tissue in her nether region, if you will, that was conducive with sexual abuse. Barbara began babysitting more kids. She decided, I'm out, right? Saving every bit of money that she could so that she could take John, Alyssa, and Sarah and get the hell away from Michael. But, oh, this is a hard but. Before she could leave, she began feeling really intense and chronic pain in her back. She finally went to the doctor, and it was discovered that she had lung cancer that had spread to her bones. Now, she had surgery to remove what they could and radiation to kill off what was left, but then it came back. She drove herself to her chemo appointments. But because she had this cancer and it was very serious, her family began coming around more to check on her, to help take care of her. One family member stated that they pulled Michael aside to kind of discuss Barbara and the very real possibility that she might die. And all Michael would talk about was John F. Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories, which of course floored that family. He talked about his issues with that union and would film or record conversations that Barbara would have with her family, even stating he needed to put black tape over the red light that showed people that the camera was on and recording. Now, Michael had really successfully actually isolated Barbara to the point that she became fairly dependent upon him. It was all about complete control, guys. And then Michael, whose three boys from his first marriage were pretty much at this point grown, left the three boys in Phoenix and moved Barbara and the girls to Redding, California. He said it was to make sure she was closer to a specialist. Barbara's sister stated that that was nonsense because there were top-of-the-line specialists in Phoenix. Redding, California, in the northern part of the state, is much more remote and much smaller. No specialists there. And I Googled it. That is very true. Or at least back then. So then Michael began to be verbally abusive and he would belittle Barbara. She got to where she lost her appetite. So one of the stories goes, for Thanksgiving that year, her two sisters went up to Redding to spend the holiday with her as she had asked them to come, and they went out for a walk. They smoked some weed, really, to get Barbara to have some kind of appetite. But when they got back, Michael was livid. He said to the kids, quote, "This is what a loser looks like. People that smoke pot are losers," end quote. He began complaining about having to take care of her and that she had lost her sex drive so he couldn't have sex with her. Vomit. So he spoke to Barbara's mother, actually, and Michael complained that Barbara was going to die and leave him with, quote, all these kids to take care of. He just seemed highly inconvenienced. Then he openly began discussing the fact that he was already looking for another wife because he wasn't going to finish raising kids by himself. I kid you not. All of this in front of his dying wife. So one of Barbara's sisters called the other sister, crying and emotional, and stated that Michael had raped her while she was trying to help them with the kids. She felt that he had drugged her. And Sarah indicated that she hoped her mother never knew that that happened. But just a few weeks before Barbara died, Michael got fired from his job. He stated it was the union messing with his life again and that there was no good reason for him to be fired. Except Sarah later, or has since, obtained documents that show that he in fact quit that job, therefore losing all health and life insurance benefits by the end of the month. Okay, so get this. On February 28th, 1993, Barbara died, as on the very last day that her benefits and life insurance would be eligible and still valid before it expired at midnight. Her friends and family believe that he very well might have been starving her and over-medicating her. Barbara's own mother began sleeping next to her daughter after witnessing Michael nearly double-dose his dying wife with medication. And it is thought that he most likely overdosed her with morphine, but of course, we don't know 100%. But either way, John, Alyssa, and Sarah's mother was gone. Michael, of course, declined. He wouldn't have anything to do with any autopsy because, of course. And then remember the third grade teacher that was going along with the whole ADD, which is really ADHD inattentive type issue? Well, Michael began sleeping with her, though Sarah did say that she was very good to her and Alyssa, especially in the, you know, after their mother died. She was very loving and very motherly, and that was a little soothing. But she was married. And the teacher slash girlfriend told the police in her report later that Michael was quite paranoid, untrusting of police officers, and was conducting several lawsuits in his spare time, something that he would just continue to do. It was like a hobby. Lawsuits were like a hobby. Okay. The teacher also said that Alyssa, at 9 years old, had sort of passed her in a hallway and announced, quote, "I'm having sex with my dad." The mandated reporter, in which teachers are, did not report this. Mandated reporter means you have to report it. It's not up to you. You can't decide not to. You have to. Michael made a recorded phone call about how Alyssa had all of these issues, that she is all but a degenerate. He referred to her as it, and that she should be spayed, and that all she would be good for was great sex. He broke things off with the teacher, and that would be the end of any girlfriends that the girls were at least aware of, Alyssa and Sarah. Sarah believes that, quite possibly, it was because of Alyssa's confession, and he could not have anyone else possibly hearing that. So at 11 years old, there exists a family video where Sarah blew out Alyssa's birthday cake candles on her cake. And we know that siblings, I mean, if she were 11, then that would make Sarah, what, 6-ish or so? You know, it's not out of the realm of normal, but of course this upset Alyssa because sibling rivalry, she blew out her candles. Any one of us would be pissed. But Michael chastised Alyssa and told her that she should tell her sister thank you for blowing out her candles. The hell. Her friends, as she neared adolescence, talked about how ornery Alyssa was, right? She's a bit of a prankster, a bit of a jokester, but they all talked about how compassionate she really was. The first to stand up for the underdog. It was kind of like me. Friends saw Michael speak to her as if she were less than. He talked down to her. When they would get into it, Alyssa would tell friends that she wished she could go live with her real father. So apparently, according to all of the sources and including people that talked to Sarah in her podcast, it seems that Alyssa took steps to make sure that Sarah was oblivious to most of the tension and the fighting between her and Michael. And she did feel a little bit of jealousy because Sarah was so adored. Sarah was basically allowed to do anything she wanted, eat anything she wanted, skip school if she wanted to, have McDonald's every night for dinner. I think that was one of her examples. And Alyssa was never extended these kinds of offers. And then when Alyssa complained, Michael would punish her and reward Sarah. Alyssa's best friend's mother who lived a few blocks away, saw the blatant abuse but was scared of Michael and what he might do. So the friend's mother would try to, at the very least, keep Alyssa at her house for chunks of time, an extra day or two. Alyssa confessed to her friend, her friend's mother, and others that Michael had been continually molesting her. In a home movie recording when the girls were still quite young, you can actually hear Alyssa announcing for the camera to her little sister that, quote, "Dad is a pervert." So, after a fake injury where Michael claimed someone from the union, that goddamn union, right, had thrown him off of a roof and shattered one of his legs. Only Sarah said he never wore a cast. There was clearly nothing wrong with that leg, and the disability he began collecting was later found out to be for psychiatric reasons, and he would go to therapy often. He had to in order to get the disability. He claimed to have PTSD from that union. Oh, the union, right? According to Sarah, he never worked again. Now, it has been agreed upon that, though he faked many of his issues, he did suffer with depression, paranoia, and extreme disturbing thoughts. And now, because he wasn't working, well, he had all the time in the world to fixate on all of his issues. So on April 5th, 1996, just after Alyssa's 12th birthday, Barbara's sister Teresa contacted Child Protective Services, or CPS, and made a report that Sarah read on her podcast. And that report said, quote, "Father Michael reportedly abuses prescription drugs and drinks alcohol daily, which makes him sleep most of the day / night. He has written at least 2 suicide notes and is depressed. Teresa was told that the home was a mess and there was no food in the home to eat. The family is in the process of being evicted because the father is too proud to sign up for food stamps. Mother died from cancer a few years ago. 18-year-old John lives in the home currently but will be moving out. Teresa is concerned about the children once John leaves." End quote. A detective noted at the bottom of this, "It should be noted that no allegations of sexual abuse are made in this complaint, but in various phone conversations, Mike Turney characterizes this complaint as alleging he, quote, beat up and raped Alyssa," end quote. Included are numerous letters that Michael wrote in response to these allegations, stating Teresa was sexually abused as a child and currently uses drugs. He also filed a false reporting police report with the Phoenix PD. Michael also stated that Stephen, Alyssa's biological father, raped her when she was so little, which is, of course, not true. Michael was very, very upset about Teresa calling CPS. The ex-girlfriend, who was the teacher, if you remember, told Alyssa after this report came in that she should keep things that happened in the home private. This is the one Alyssa told that she was having sex with her father. This teacher, who's also a mandated reporter, told her what happens at home should stay private. And so that really gets us to the end of part one, okay? It is important that you know all of this stuff about Michael, because Michael is the one suspected to have something to do with Alyssa's disappearance. So I just wanted to make sure that you guys have sort of all of the broad strokes, the backstory, and you have an idea, kind of get in Michael's head and get a really true sort of sense of what kind of person he is. It's all about control and narcissism and paranoia and recording any and all phone calls. And he's just convinced that the union is coming, you know, the electrician's union is coming to get him. They're going to kill him and so on and so forth. It is ridiculous. So again, that's part one. Thank you guys so much for listening. I cannot wait to get into part two. And as always, I really appreciate each and every one of you, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you keep choosing me. And I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, guys. I want you to have a great day.
Anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.